Part C. In this part of the test, you'll hear two different extracts. In each extract, you'll hear health professionals talking about aspects of their work. For questions 31 to 42, choose the answer A, B, or C, which fits best according to what you hear. Complete your answers as you listen. Now look at Extract 1. Extract 1. Questions 31 to 36. You hear an interview with a cardiologist called Dr. Jack Robson, who's an expert on Chagas disease. You now have 90 seconds to read questions 31 to 36.
Today we're talking to Dr. Jack Robson, a cardiologist and Chagas disease specialist in the USA. Dr. Robson, what is Chagas disease and why is it referred to as a neglected disease?
Chagas is caused by a parasite called Trypanosoma cruzi. Most sufferers become infected when they're bitten by an insect, commonly known as the kissing bug, which carries the parasite.
Right.
People often don't realize they've been bitten, and during the initial phase of the infection, symptoms are normally mild or absent.
Okay.
70% of those infected never develop complications. For the other 30%, the disease tends to remain silent for a long time, often 30 years, but it eventually enters a chronic phase characterized by serious cardiac, digestive system, and neurological disorders. About 7 million people worldwide are thought to have Chagas, but it attracts relatively little publicity or funding for research. This indifference is largely down to it being primarily a disease of marginalized communities in Latin America, where it's endemic. Mm. You need resources to force significant action.
Right, I see. And are there any concerns in the USA about Chagas?
Yes, the insect carrying the parasite is actually endemic to the southern U.S. states. Mm. Since 1955, however, no more than 30 people have been bitten and infected while in the USA. The alarming thing, though, is that it's become apparent that large numbers of first-generation and some second-generation immigrants from Latin America carry Chagas, around 300,000.
Right.
These people won't infect others, apart from congenitally and possibly through blood transfusion, but a significant proportion end up chronically ill.
And for the benefit of our listeners, can you describe an individual case?
Well, this year, a Bolivian woman, let's call her Marisol, asked me if she could be tested for Chagas. She's a long-term U.S. resident, but she'd recently been on vacation in Bolivia, and at one point she had felt unwell. This often occurs with changes in diet and living conditions, and that's what Marisol assumed was the cause. She'd actually been planning to donate blood in Bolivia, but changed her mind at the last minute. Ironically, if she'd gone ahead, the screening would have detected Chagas.
I see.
Hearing from relatives that Chagas can be transmitted congenitally was what prompted Marisol to come to my clinic. She and her partner wanted to start a family, and she was scared that she might pass the parasite on. Tests then showed she did indeed have intermediate stage Chagas.
And what issues can arise in treating Chagas?
Well, another patient, I'll call her Jennifer, felt unwell following a vacation in a region where Chagas is endemic. Tests indicated she was Chagas positive. Jennifer was then referred to my clinic where we do further tests. Meanwhile, she looked up Chagas online and understandably was distressed by what she read. "Why me?" she once said to me. She was also fearful about taking benznidazole, the main drug used for Chagas, because it has potentially harmful side effects. For optimum impact, it should be taken in the first 2 months of the disease, but by the time the testing had been completed, 10 weeks had passed since the likely date of the bite. For information, Jennifer took benznidazole and didn't react badly to it.
And do you deal with patients in later stages of the illness?
Yes, I have a 62-year-old patient called Juan. 8 years ago, he was diagnosed with dilated cardiomyopathy, and Chagas was also detected in him. If he'd been tested for Chagas earlier in his life, his long-term prospects would have been better. A year after the diagnosis, Juan was found to have type 2 diabetes. This was dealt with relatively well, though his body did initially reject insulin. Juan took drugs for his heart and for several years was reasonably stable, but eventually monitoring revealed severe cardiac deterioration. His experience is very much what you'd expect in someone who's had the disease for years, and it's reached the latter stages. There's no cure, and the main recommendations are rest, exercise, and appropriate diet.
I see. And what can be done to combat Chagas generally?
Plenty. Researchers are working on improved drugs to treat it and a vaccine. None currently exists, but it takes at least 10 years to supply a new drug. Another idea is to develop the existing drugs in tablets of different sizes. That could and should be done almost overnight. What's currently available is designed for adults, even though infants often have the disease. There are also some very important programs using insecticides and other methods to wipe out the bugs that transfer Chagas to humans, but initiatives like those take decades rather than years.
Well, Dr. Jack Robson, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Now look at Extract 2. Extract 2. Questions 37 to 42. You hear an occupational therapist called Anna Matthews giving a presentation to a group of trainee doctors. You now have 90 seconds to read questions 37 to 42.
Hi, my name's Anna Matthews. I'm an occupational therapist working here in the hospital. In a moment, I'm going to present a case study to you to show you the type of work I do. But first, let's think about what we understand by occupational therapy and the part it plays in patients' recovery. In simple terms, therapists like me help patients of all ages to participate in the things they want or need to do, through the therapeutic use of a range of recognized activities. For example, this could be helping patients who are recovering from illness or injury to regain skills and get back to work. Or it could be supporting older adults who are going through physical and cognitive changes. What I always have to keep in mind, however, is what the individual wants to achieve. I always say that a doctor's first question is, what's the matter with you? Whereas my first question is, what matters to you? Now, onto my case study. It involves a patient called Ted, a 60-year-old man whose motorbike was in collision with a car. Luckily, the accident happened at moderate speed, but he still suffered compound fractures in both legs, in one arm, and several broken ribs. When I first met him, after 2 weeks in hospital, he was physically and emotionally broken. After all, not only was his mobility in question, but much more importantly, so was his style. Doctors had told him that he might never be able to squeeze into his motorbike leathers again. So he'd given up. Imagine how he must have felt. One day, totally independent, and the next, suddenly unable to do things anymore. Ted showed little interest in receiving treatment. Some colleagues at the hospital took the view that if he stubbornly refused to help himself, there was little they could do. It was his right, they said. But I didn't agree. Since Ted couldn't use his legs or right arm, I made sure we concentrated on what he could do with his left hand. For example, I worked on strategies to help him dress himself and things like that. We even worked on fine motor skills, like writing with his left hand. I wanted to make sure that even if he didn't ever regain use of his right arm, I could at least get him to function by whatever other means were open to him. So, how did my therapy help? Well, I worked with Ted on his hands, putting playing cards on a table and getting him to pick one up, which he couldn't do. But he then resorted to sliding the cards off the table and picking them up that way, finding a way of compensating for what he couldn't do. He'd become upset about what he felt was his lack of progress. Relearning to do things you used to do with ease can be frustrating. But in time, I got him to see that if he didn't work with me, then he'd stay as he was for the rest of his life. That was a big motivating factor. Ted had therapy for 8 months, and he had his ups and downs. For example, the day when he finally had the plaster casts removed from his legs. He built it up in his mind into a great step towards independence. In reality, of course, it wasn't. He was still unable to stand because he'd lost a lot of strength, and the doctors were still predicting he'd remain in a wheelchair. Although I'd warned him about all this, that moment still came as a big disappointment. But strangely, when something like that happens, it can be a turning point. Like many patients, Ted became even more determined to regain mobility after that. Anyway, you'll be delighted to know that Ted's story had a happy ending. He's now back at home and back at work too. Learning to walk again took every ounce of energy he had. But patients like Ted, with that fighting spirit, go from strength to strength after discharge. That's where the support of family can be invaluable. As long as they don't inhibit the patient by warning them of potential dangers at every turn. But patients like Ted tend to take charge of their own ongoing recovery. Gym membership, therapy regime, that kind of thing. Seeing that gives me a real sense of pride in the work I do and the difference it can make to people.
That is the end of Part C. You now have 2 minutes to check your answers. That is the end of the listening test.